Join us as we cover many an insane movie and numerous cult TV phenomenons. Are you ready to get jacked up? Are you with us? Then listen on.
Welcome back. So tonight, ladies and gents, we're talking about M. Night Shyamalan's best-known original superhero franchise that chronicles Mr. Glass and David Dunn and Kevin Crumb all in one giant trilogy. So with me tonight, I got special guests, filmmakers John Killian.
Hello.
Yes. And James Denton.
James Brenton.
I would fuck up. I'm the name. I was going to doing so good tonight.
And you were doing good.
Third telecast. I fuck up the name. James Brenton. Yeah. Glad to have you on here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. So I'm just going to circle around. Brenton, when did you get into this atypical saga?
Well, it's kind of a funny story. I actually lived out in Delaware back in the end of '99, and so I was packing up to move back to Indiana. Ooh. And I got a phone call from my production company, and they were looking for production assistance.
Oh,
and for a little movie called Unbreakable. The worst part about it was literally the only thing left in my apartment was the phone that I answered, because I had packed everything in a U-Haul that day and I was leaving. So I had no place to stay. I had, you know, no money, and I was moving back to Indiana. And I mean, it wasn't a paid gig. You know, they were looking for extra people at the last minute. And I still,
it was a pretty low production. I know Bruce Willis took a pay cut, like filmed it for like $400 for the day, like simple minimum SAG scale for both that and Sixth Sense. So yeah, It was definitely very lower budget for mainstream. And
yeah, man, and I just, that was kind of my intro was I, you know, I had seen, you know, Sixth Sense and I was a fan and was looking forward to this one. I had read a little bit about this one coming in.
You knew who you were working for, getting coffee for.
Right, right. So I was very disappointed, but I was, you know, looking forward to seeing it when it came out. And I know it made its money, but I know it wasn't, you know, it didn't, you know, resonate with people the way The Sixth Sense did.
Yeah, I would constantly, I was in high school and I just saw the original on Sci-Fi Channel quite a lot and USA Network back in the day. And I just could see why so many people had gotten into it back in the day. And it was just kind of this sleeper hit. Well, Sixth Sense had taken the world by storm, and M. Night was kind of just once again, just kind of experimenting. No one knew how to interpret what he was going to do next. If he was going to do a Twilight Zone kind of thing, or even in, especially what he does with, like the plot twist to Glass, kind of go even a little more X-Files-ish, where, you know, there's this alternate city and underworld.
Right, right.
Of people. And like you say, I mean, you know, this was back in the day when you were contracting, you know, for film or getting a film gig, you know, you just had to read the yellow pages or know someone who knew someone. You know, this is not where it is today, where now if you want a film production gig, you got to literally be signed up to a site that gets gigs for people for just that, you know, and whoever makes it, you know, gets the gig, you know.
Right, right. Yeah. And, I'd been out in Philly, Philadelphia area for a few years. And so I was, I was hoping to grab stuff like that while I was out there. And I got to do one, I did some production work on one film while I was out there. And then, so I was looking forward to getting my next gig and it wasn't happening. So I was running low on cash and, you know, bolted back to the Midwest.
I know what you mean. It sucks because, you know, this is back then, you know, before the internet where everything can be done, you know, over your phone. You know, it's like, no, you had to keep a wallet in a mental picture of it in your mind at all times, you know?
Yeah, definitely, definitely the early ages of the internet, you know, with the whole, you know, Blair Witch and all that stuff. So I really did. I enjoyed Unbreakable. I think what really stood out for me there was a lot of these shots that were just, they were long and just everything, all the action just kind of happened within that frame. And it just kind of really, and they would do these really long tracking shots and they were just, I don't know, it kind of stuck with me. It was so slow. It was such a slow burn, you know, and I'm not going to say that.
We had Christopher Nolan, you know, doing mind games with us. Yeah.
Right. Right. And I wasn't, you know, I'm not going to say that I was hoping for a little more punch, you know, in the third act. But I still really enjoyed it. I loved the crap out of the show and was happy to see that it, you know, secretly starting out became the trilogy that it is.
Absolutely. I'm with you 100%. So Killian, man, when did you jump aboard this and just find that more and more uncommonly done movies?
I was lucky enough to actually see it the week that it came out in the theaters.
Because it was a PG-13 movies and it was made its money back, but you know it wasn't for kids. You know, even
no
the disclaimer. You know, it's produced by Disney's, you know, more adult, you know, Touchstone Pictures, and gets a PG-13 for a mature sexual reference and intense, you know, thrills.
But I took to it pretty quick. It was, obviously I'm a bit of a nerd, bit of a comic book fan. Absolutely. I wear like a badge on my sleeve, man.
I'm Mr. Geekster. I had no thoughts. I was the quiet kid who did his homework and went home so he could watch just some cartoons and TV and then hang out with family who were going to tell campfire stories.
Yep. Yeah. Pretty much the same. But I took to it pretty fast. It was, it was the most intense and human version of on the concept of a superhero movie that I had ever seen at that point. And I do think because it's somewhat grounded in realism, like it's a really divisive flick because when you're going into this, you're expecting one thing, but you kind of like it only meets it halfway. And to me, it almost felt like Unbreakable was intentionally kind of anticlimactic in that sense.
That's a good way of putting it. Cause I mean, we'd had other original kind of unofficially done like superhero kind of movies and shows. The Sentinel was a campy, you know, people goes around and have supernatural strength. Alphas was a big hit on Sci-Fi, and RoboCop, you know, was a big, you know, what the Batman movie should have been back in the day.
Spawn was, yeah, right. Absolutely. But nobody had quite taken it to that level of grittiness. Honestly, now
philosophical.
That since we're talking about this and talking about the tone of this film, and I just want to point something out really quick. Think of the emotional tone of the film and the color palette used, and I can't help but wonder if Christopher Nolan might have added
him, then definitely David S. Goyer, you know.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Of course,
you know, was doing Blade around the same time and then worked on Dark Knight and the newest Terminator. But yeah, no, I mean, even just Mr. Glass in and of himself, I mean, you're feeling sorry for, you know, it's a man in a wheelchair who hangs out at a comic book shop, and you feel sorry for him when he gets, you know, jumped by some random, you know, subway thugs. And then to find out, you know, we're really not spoiling anything. Anyone just about, much like Sixth Sense, it knows about the plot twist ending, but we're telling you why it works, you know. And it's like to realize right, that he felt, you know, that he had to send a message to society and, you know, unleash his grief on the world, you know. It's like, it's just such a fun brooding thing, you know. It's like you never even got, I kind of found just the character kind of, now that I think about it, kind of similar to the old man, you know, in Phantasm, kind of just that boy, you know, just but not as intense. And maybe even Cancer Man in X-Files, just that guy who just has no shame about what he is.
Right.
Yeah.
And it was very interesting to find out, you know, after the fact, which kind of goes with, you know, with what you were saying about being kind of anticlimactic, is the fact that I think, you know, I read originally that, you know, Knight really wanted this trilogy was actually kind of one script concept. And then they ended up,
he didn't know where it was going to go, yeah, but he so wanted he split to end it. There. Yeah.
Well, he split the, no pun intended.
Split the splits.
He split the, he split his
story. Oh, he said the thing. He said the thing.
Yes, I said the thing. And because I know that there's actually, you know, there's a moment in Unbreakable where David Dunn is standing in the crowd and the one woman walks by and he has the flashes of abuse of the child.
Mm-hmm.
And that in the original concept was going to be Crumb.
That's so true. You don't, we act like it only began because of Split. It's like, no, he even went back there. I mean, because I mean, even when you get the glass, you got even just other guys, like the guy doing security at the stadium showing up, you know.
okay, so James, I would appreciate you if you could possibly send me your sources for that, because I heard something completely different. This is
really okay. Go
we're
ahead.
We're gonna get it fun. This is gonna get fun.
We're gonna do some research on the research. Yeah.
I can already tell this is gonna require at least one or two follow-up episodes. And once we go down this rabbit hole, right? So
fantastic.
Maybe.
Yeah. All right. So apparently, yes, this was totally envisioned originally as a trilogy. But because he didn't have those original two written, and maybe that's where what you said came into play. All right, I'm sorry. Bear with me here.
Yeah, because The Visit was very low budget, filmed for like $1,000. And so he was back to stage one where he kind of just wanted to revisit.
Right. All right.
It can very well be that both what you're saying are true, but it's changed at various stages in development. I don't know.
Well, here's what I heard is that around I don't know, was it 2006 or 7 where he produced that film called The Devil by the Dwaddle Brothers?
Yes, just Devil. He worked with them. He put his name on it and helped them bring it to executives, and he got some power back after doing a bunch of other projects. Yeah.
That was the first installment of his failed Night Chronicles concept, which was supposed to be like an anthology series of films that were he would produce and possibly write, but he wouldn't necessarily direct. And since Devil didn't really take off the way that they were hoping it would, the concept kind of fizzled out. But the
around that same time. He was working on a Tales from the Crypt reboot that didn't take off because TNT had no interest in it.
Right.
So, he was pigeonholing through a bunch of stuff, seeing what can I do that someone will say yes to.
Right. So the next script that was supposed to be produced was a film called 12 Angry Men. And this is simultaneously supposed to refer to a jury and also a man with multiple personalities.
Nice.
So that's where it comes into play. So I'm wondering, like, you mentioned this whole possible link that that moment of child abuse that Dunn experienced earlier on could have potentially been McAvoy's character from Split, Kevin.
I think I found his source, though. There's like a rule of crumb from Total Film. So I guess take that with a grain of salt from like 2018.
That's great.
So it could very easily be, it is meant to be the same character, but he didn't say it up front. I'm sure we would also have to spend hours again, listening to the commentary tracks on the Blu-rays.
Right.
Getting a fill, but
having a commentary on the commentary, aren't we?
Oh, totally. And I mean, this is kind of what I liked, because around the same time, you know, they launched other stuff like Heroes and everything. They were always kind of doing their own take on kind of an X-Men kind of universe where various people with different powers exist in a same shady kind of, you know, town or place. And so, yeah, I mean, it's very obvious. I think even by the end of Glass, you could even say that there's other people besides, you know, Kevin Crumb or David Dunn or Mr. Right. Glass.
Did you guys ever hear about the original ending that was planned for Glass?
If I did, it's been a minute. So,
this might be all speculation and, you know, like Reddit rabbit holes or whatever you call it. But
I read it. No, it's good.
Originally, like if he got a larger budget, and this is all hearsay, as I say again, so please. Anybody who writes in the camera about this shit, please. Yeah, disclaimer. I may be talking out of my ass, and I'm aware of that.
Half the time, they remove stuff from IMDb because it is just that speculation. Yeah.
And if you want to correct us, just don't be a dick about it.
Right.
You got it wrong.
God, I get so many of those every time I butch Latin on my occult episodes. It's fucking ridiculous. The original ending was supposed to be like kind of like full blown superhero spectacle. The whole thing that he was talking about enticing the two villain or the two rivals to meet on top of that skyscraper at one of the, like, you know, he keeps going on and on about this plan. The original script had that in there.
Oh, okay.
Very cool.
Is it because of the, you know, like we said, you know, Unbreakable and Split weren't the biggest money makers. Do you think that's why they toned it down? Or was it, do you think, in your opinion, do you think that's kind of a, you know what, let's keep it more grounded? Do you think he kind of decided himself to turn it around?
That's a good question. I have
no idea.
It seems like that would be nuts. Yeah. And I think, I want to think that, you know, by the time he finished up with Split, that maybe that was it. He was like, listen, everybody's kind of got this, it's grounded in reality. If we turn it into, you know, the Avengers before the Avengers.
Well, what I found really interesting is that there was a very brief interview with Samuel L. Jackson where he admitted that there was an... Say what again? Say what again? One more goddamn time. No, he admitted that there was a total different ending for it, and he wouldn't talk about it. He wasn't explicitly open about it, but the one
he's thing actually Nick Fury, if he went
right. The one thing that I found really interesting is that he said we shut it down because there was some we removed that concept because there was some content within those scenes that was inappropriate to do with what was going on at the world at the time. And he did not elaborate beyond that. So I have no freaking idea.
That really means. You do kind of get kind of an urban kind of terror kind of feel like you might get with something like Candyman, where you definitely kind of tell that Mr. Glass has probably been wronged.
Yeah. Oh man. Did you guys see the new Candyman?
Not yet. I need to.
You guys need to watch it. We should probably do a commentary on it.
I've heard good things.
Yeah, yeah. Watch the original first, and then immediately.
Oh, I'm in love with the trilogy, so yeah.
No. Ignore the trilogy. This is
so much
better.
I love part two. Great blue. Oh, good. Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would not be surprised if something changed in development, because you can tell even before, you know, we were locking down. I mean, that's kind of why I put my film career on pause. It's like everyone was just misbehaving and not doing, already pretty unorganized. So it's like, last thing I need to do is get sick while you're being unorganized. And it's like, yeah, before we're having to worry about COVID, there was definitely a lot of people who are having to be reminded, hey, make sure that, you know, you're being very sensitive about what you're portraying, you know, on screen, you know, because last thing we need to do is have a movie be dead before it comes out because, you know, of how something fictional is being portrayed that echoes some of today's real life.
Oh yeah. A lot of productions in the last 2 years, we've started to show up a whole hell of a lot more in media, and you know, because it's relevant to the times. So
it really is. And like you say, it's just very frustrating that some people still don't get it. They're like, yeah, they're gonna bitch anyway. I'm like, they don't have to if you don't invite them. Say less. Keep it very mysterious. I mean, it'd be way better if a critic misinterpreted it, because it's not like anyone pays attention to what they say, you know,
right.
unless they're loyal to Rotten Tomatoes.
So we've tickled on the front and the back end of the story, but what about the meaty middle split? Like
the meaty middle.
The meaty middle.
I think, like you say, I mean, it just made sense. You know, McAvoy had done all kinds of things, Children of Dune, X-Men, and so it just wanted. And so
I wish I could find a copy of Children of Dune right now.
I can send you an online link, even though it's not, you know, we're talking about legal. Well,
thanks, buddy. Sure. That's, yep. Let's just bleep that out, but absolutely.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Seriously. I really looked out. I found a very cheap Makari cell where I got him for $40. That in the 2000 miniseries, and I was like, unbelievable. Because if you go on Amazon now, you're gonna have to pay like $200. I'm like, no,
it's ridiculous. It's nuts.
Just because of the value that these sellers put on. But yeah, no.
You know, I was shocked. Not shocked. Shocked's not the right word.
McAvoy was chosen to do this. Well,
when I first heard that, I was like, okay. And he was able to, you know, literally, he should have won some awards for that. I mean, watching him actually change personalities as he just moved through a scene was amazing.
You would have thought something, at least give a, maybe, if not a Golden Globe, maybe just some kind of Saturn Award that honors more sci-fi horror type movies.
I mean, I think he was really kind of slighted on this, because I mean, just watching his transformation almost physically, the way he moved his body, and you know, I know they, I'm sure they digitally added like the veins on him and stuff like that when he turned into the Beast. But like just watching him carry himself from the different personalities. I mean, I know what they said, he had like 23 or 24, but we only saw like what?
By Glass, like, I could have sworn they said 150 or something, you know?
Oh, no. And, it was somewhere in
the 20s.
Upper 20s, it's maybe even low 30s. And between the two movies, we saw all but four of them.
Okay.
That's right. Especially near the end. But
it was really interesting to see that Jason Blum produced this.
Yeah, he
and it was on, because you know, that
he
guy
needed something else outside of The Purge and Happy Death Day, and then his other Universal franchises, and then when relaunching The Invisible Man and Halloween, is like, he pretty much took it upon himself. He's like, I want to give M. Night a better shot, because I see that, you know, he's been screwed over by Fox. They blocked him out of every other movie he did for them. You know, I'm not going to treat him like shit. The guy's talented.
Right. And you know, the thing is, like, I guess from what I can remember, it was some kind of deal with Disney from Unbreakable, where he held on to the rights.
Not coming to Disney Plus anytime soon.
Yeah. he held on to the rights for any sequels that were going to be made from Unbreakable. And I believe that it was Split. I can't remember if it was Split or Glass, but one of them, it was kind of unheard of because they actually teamed up. They didn't think they were going to get...
I think it was Glass, because, the other one, like, Bruce Willis wasn't even credited. It was just an Easter egg at the end. And it was so wild. People took a while to even talk about it. And then other people saw it, and they're like, oh, that's right. He is playing the same guy as in Glass. And I mean, I forgot about it until I saw it on HBO One following day. I'm like, oh, that's right. Oh, okay. I forgot. This is Unbreakable Chapter 2, technically. It's in the same
universe. And I was really glad that I stayed away from that. Like, I'm glad I didn't find that out early. And it was great, because I had read that, you know, after I saw Split, I had read that M. Night he took that scene out whenever he did screenings before he released it.
He didn't want to have anyone say anything else. And
so nobody knew, you know, in the media. Cool. So all those screenings that they put out, you know,
that's why it's not in any of the reviews,
the test audiences and stuff like that. He removed that. So not to have it in there.
That's true. And I
because
didn't
he
see
originally
any critic talk about it.
Right. And he had, I believe he actually even came out and tried to play it off as, you know, oh, well, this isn't necessarily a sequel, it's just in the same universe.
Totally. He at this point, you know, he had gotten some respect back. He had done Wayward Pines for two seasons on Fox, so you know, he couldn't go wrong at this point, but he wanted to gain the upper hand and just say, hey, I'm going to choose what I want to do at this point. And if I sense that anywhere that this is going to be a hit, another hit for Blumhouse, then I'm going to choose what to do from this point on, you know?
Right. And Flug, what did you think of, how did you think of, you know, McAvoy in this?
I didn't mind it. It was kind of a more kind of a, I want to say kind of a Silence of the Lambs, kind of a hostage thriller kind of movie.
Yeah.
And but it was really good at just playing, sticking even to the Romero playbooks. One location, five actors, you know?
That was, that or Hitchcock or something.
It was a very intense PG-13 once again, you know, it's like what would normally be rated R. They hinted at it.
Was that PG-13? Really?
Yeah, I couldn't believe it, but it was just one of those. And
wow.
I do think the ads kind of goofed it up a bit because you just kind of figured, oh, it's a psycho thriller with an actor hamming it up. But that's still, it was a hit one way or the other. And it
You're right. But between the personalities of Patricia and his total freaking nutso breakdown at the end as the Beast. We're definitely like up into seven Silence of the Lambs. even audition level psycho, which is, good times. Good times for the family. It's a great family film. Really.
Everyone should see it.
Oh yeah. Everyone should see it.
It's a super,
but no, really, just a girl and her boyfriend who hates horror but takes her to it are gonna see it. But yeah, it is interesting how it's just like it was just all the more powerful from what it didn't get all graphic up on. I was even more surprised with how gruesome parts of Glass get near the end when he's biting into some of the security guards, you know, ears and everything. It's just like it was just in very atypical kind of movie, and it was just all the better because it just was kind of just a sleeper hit. Just no one knew what to expect. And most people who generally saw it were pretty impressed.
It proved one of M. Night's best and worst qualities. It left me wanting more, and we're not going to get any more.
It was kind of imperfect, but it was also
I kind of applaud him for it, but I also kind of want to buy him a beer and then punch him in the face for it too. It's no, I take that back. No, if I ever saw the guy, I would, of course, I'd buy him dinner. I would just love to pick his brain.
Why do you end your movies a certain way? And cause I was hearing people even go back and forth on how they feel about The Visit or Old. And it seems like he does like
to see Old.
Well, From what I hear, it is kind of one of those, you got to be in the mood to see, again, just kind of a multi-character drama and go along with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, those two, I haven't seen Old. I have not seen The Visit.
It was better than I thought it was going to be.
Okay.
I had some issues with it. But
don't get me wrong. I got issues with every single one of his films. And that's the thing to remember, like we were talking about before we even hit record is...
Yeah.
Like, I love M. Night Shyamalan's, I hope I said that right. Shyamalan, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, yeah, Shyamalan. But yeah, like you say, everyone has their pros and cons. Like, Scorsese doesn't know how to write female characters. Spielberg likes to get a little preachy. And Nolan likes to have one twist too many. And M. Night is kind of, he's just never 100% in any area. Sometimes he has a cool character.
Yeah, but the thing is, like, he is one of the, like, bravest attempts at creativity that I've
seen. He takes a risk.
Like, he does. He really does. And eventually, like, he'll hit his opus. This is almost like the Quentin Tarantino scenario where, you know, like Tarantino kind of blew his wad with Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
And then he gets
with
all that Weinstein money, baby. Yeah.
Oh, God. That's not uncomfortable at all.
No. I don't regret it at all, even though I knew what he was doing. Make me my career. I love you.
Oh, man.
Oh, dear. Yeah, no, I even saw people who were even looking forward to this franchise, and they did not want to take a chance on it. They were displeased with early reviews, even though they typically disagree with critics. I even had a pal who kind of liked how it began, and he hated how it ended. He's like, but they didn't do an all-out, you know, superhero team-up or beat-up. I'm like, it wasn't ever going to be that kind of movie. But see, again, you're watching the trailers. You think everything has to be like the movie, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it was very, it was one of those things where I guess the, you know, the twist, if you will, for Glass, you know, I was, because, you know, let's face it, you know, M. Night, that's kind of his hook. He's always wanting to surprise the audience at the end in some fashion. Whether or not it really works, that's to be discussed. But
no twist is ever 100%, but if it can be like the Twilight Zone where you're talking about it, then good on you, you know?
Right. Well, and with like Glass, you know, I really didn't see, the twist with the doctor.
No, not at all. Not even, I mean, even people were constantly even, I normally get very anal retentive about how people act in a certain universe, fictional or not. And I was just like, you know, they're clearly being like, you know, a Gotham City kind of guy who doesn't have a good grip on the Joker, you know, is like, everybody is just kind of just saying, well, these patients can't be any worse than anyone else. So that's why, you know, these guys have let their guard down and these, you know, all three personas are, you know, breaking out. And it just kind of just took great advantage of its world. It just fleshed it out a little more, and then it just said, hey, and by the way, we are going to end it, you know, no more.
Yeah, so and don't it was get too really, comfortable. Yeah, and it was really interesting how, you know, looking back, you know, the way she, Sarah Paulson's character, you know, each, I guess, cell, if you will, you know, you look at it now, and it was in fact like a prison for superheroes.
Yes,
more than it was a psych ward. And you know, it was because I remember watching, going, "Well, this is a pretty fancy setup for a psych ward." Mm-hmm. And so I kept kind of going with the, okay, this is the universe we live in this movie, and she still kind of surprised me at the end, though I, you know, wondered, you know, okay, wait a minute here. it's a little out in left field. I was hoping to see a little more from what is it? Dunn's kid.
Mm-hmm.
Joseph.
Yeah.
I kept thinking, okay, he's got to do something, because they brought him in, and the same actor, which was fantastic to see this kid.
Right.
Growing up,
you know, 19 years later, playing the, you know, coming back and playing the same role. It was great.
Okay, all so right. That is an interesting fact. I did not know that was the same actor.
Yeah, same actor.
Mm-hmm. Same kid.
Yeah. 19 years same, later.
19 years later. And Bruce Willis, I really got to hand it off to him. He's been just so hit and miss lately, kind of pulling Eric Roberts, being in all kinds of movies, just with the producers of 16 Blocks and Hostage, for better or worse. He's just always in a movie, like, six movies a year, and this one he seemed really invested in, kind of like he was with Red movies, where he's right. Like he really is getting very emotional with this is kind of why he responded to M. Night to begin with, because for the longest time he was just, everyone wanted him to do kind of a knockoff of Fifth Element or Die Hard, you know, instead of actually just do a very dramatically rewarding role. And he just kind of got that with this kind of just, I mean, in the first movie, you see it where he's not able to really be as great a father as he would like to be. And he's already trying to come to terms with, how did I survive the train crash? I should have been dead, you know? But yeah, no, I'm with you. I really liked how they showed how the son had progressed. They kind of got their own kind of private eye on official agency where, you know, they're checking out supernatural happenings, you know?
Yeah, I did enjoy that.
Technology, and he's doing the investigating, because you don't have to worry about him actually dying. He's fine.
She's right. Like Scully meets Nurse Ratched. Oh, God. What a terrible weekend that would be.
Yeah, it would be something.
But there was... There was a whole lot of this whole trilogy that I definitely wish that they would expand upon. And the thing that I was going to geek out on a few minutes ago is the fact that, are we looking at another David Lynch revisiting Twin Peaks scenario. Is this guy going to show up when he's like 78 years old start dropping, like, all of a sudden you have a television series about the super underground keepers of the secrets, so to speak, Illuminati.
I think this is it.
That's what that was. That was the Illuminati.
Yeah. That's totally how I felt about the end. It's like, that is an Illuminati ending. But yeah, it was kind of one of those where it's like, I think he just kind of had his fun in the sun. He normally wouldn't have done something like this, but then he just realized, if I be a little sneaky and I create a franchise without nothing that he had his time to just kind of soak in all his criticisms and just being fed up with how the studio systems were going about things. So I think he just knew, is like, I will choose how I want to end my story from this point on, regardless of who has the rights, you know?
Mm-hmm. And, right. And it was kind of like it's kind of like M. Night's version of Batman with the Court of Owls. You know, I mean, that's kind of what it felt like to me at the end. I was like, oh my gosh, Bruce Willis is Bruce Wayne.
Oh, totally.
And his son is kind of like
a different kind of Bruce. Yeah.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Minus the part where I have a cancer type voice.
Oh, where's Rachel?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, seriously. It's like if Bruce Wayne grew up in the hardened cities of Philly, man. Like, come on.
Yeah. Philly, Chicago type stuff. Yeah. And then
I loved, and I tell you what, you know, the one other thing that I really liked about, you know, I don't have it obviously in front of me. His you know, cinematographer for
really Glass. A great cinematographer. Yeah,
I mean, and that and his, I guess, production team, just because of the lighting and the colors that they used. You know, they kept like the purple obviously with Glass, mm-hmm. and then he wore the green. Always everything was kind of a green tone, and then you had the yellows for McAvoy and, you know, the Beast and whatnot.
Yeah.
He even wore like the yellow jumpsuit.
Oh yeah.
And the headphones. Yeah. And I just thought that when I finally got a chance to see Glass, I was hoping to get a little more expansion from it, but I just thought that as a filmmaker, he did a really good job with creating that universe. And I did, it was kind of like, oh, look, it's kind of a version of Batman. You know, he's trying to figure out, you know, obviously it's Batman with quote unquote superpowers, superhuman Batman.
Yes.
Cause he's not rich and blah, blah, blah. But you know, I just kind of
poor bastard.
Right. I liked it because it was, it wasn't the CGI fest that the Avengers was.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
It was an anti-superhero movie, and cinematographer that you mentioned it has done a lot of other Blumhouse A24 type stuff and is currently filming M. Night's Servant show for Apple. So,
okay, Cam, I love that you brought that up, because there is one specific thing I would really like to dive into before I run out of time here. And I hope you guys continue the discussion after I have to bail.
Okay.
Obviously, this is going to be the first of many over this nutty trilogy, because we really didn't even tackle in the split all that much. And man, I got a lot to say about that from a psychological standpoint. But James,
oh, it ties into Glass. It's fine.
what is your like? I know that you're involved with obviously like photography and film work. Are you a cinematographer? Are you?
I'm a freelancer, and I do video production. That's, you know, that's my career. And then
congrats on you.
Thank you. And then recently I was brought in to be the director of photography on a film, H.P. Lovecraft's Witch House. And a friend of mine who wrote it and directed it brought me in to shoot that. And we are now right now currently in kind of the global festival circuit, if you will. So that's kind of where I'm at. And that's my background is basically shooting and editing. I do a lot of corporate video, which is, you know, talking heads and stuff like that. But go ahead.
The specific reason I asked you that, I'll get to in here in a second, but the movie, the Witch House. Yeah.
Yes.
Is there a trailer out there for it anywhere?
There is. I can share it with you after, we'll have to locate you on the intraweb.
Yeah, please. Like you're talking, like I am horror film fanatic, and I love Lovecraft. So,
bring okay, it on. great. Yeah.
But the reason I brought that up is, what did you think about the whole color scheme thing that they were doing throughout the course of the film,
like? Especially in the water, it looks that discolored, just like in water.
Yeah.
It just shows it just shows even just their suffering, like Glass, Unbreakable and Split kind of stuck with a lot of darker exteriors and corridors.
This was kind of vibrant by comparison, although with incredibly dull backgrounds.
Yeah. Even if they survive and go back out in the open, they'll be rejected by society. And it just showed a lot of contrasts. And
when I love the one that really stuck out to me was when she first brings them all together in the room, everything is kind of like this pink or fuchsia kind of, the lighting is all just very, it's different from the rest of the film, and you see all three of them together in this room.
I picked up on that too. I had the joy of seeing it in the theater, and you know, me and my sister were just wiped out by the end of it. But yeah, we noticed there was anyone else would have kind of done kind of a claustrophobic or kind of a voyeuristic kind of perspective, and yeah, they went for just, they had each of them, anytime they're in the room, they represent different kinds of colors. You see a lot of purple in Glass's close ups. You see a lot of, yeah, like you say, the yellow.
Well, and if you, in specific, you know, that one scene where all three of them are in the same room together and she's sitting there interviewing all of them, it's there in every frame, but really, really subtle. Like, I thought, I really praised the cinematography to that, because like when it went vibrant, it really stood out, but there was a whole lot of subtlety, like almost to the level of how horror filmmakers like tend to stick things in the background somewhere that
little Easter eggs.
Yeah. And it's these little simple,
the best kind, not the distracting kind.
It could be the smallest little object or the slightest little fraction of the light coming through the window that just briefly alters the color of the frame to fit that specific character. So Mr. Glass obviously had purple, Kevin was yellow, and David was
green.
Yeah.
And I thought that was fantastic. I loved how they did that, and they kept that color palette, you know. They took it from Unbreakable, and they still, and for David Dunn, you know, Bruce Willis's character. And I thought the cinematographer, I know it wasn't the same cinematographer from Unbreakable, I'm not sure if it was or not, but
it wasn't. Yeah, you're right. I was looking at the list. Okay.
And so I did like, you know, the color scheme. I thought that they did a really good job, and you know, I it's funny because, to be honest, I'm a casual, I mean, I love watching movies, but I get to the point where, you know, when I go watch a movie, I really try my hardest not to pick it apart. I always end up kind of doing that, but I want to just go in and be entertained. You know, if you can entertain,
figure out what does or doesn't work. Like,
right, I can do that. We even said that
with we even said that with the new Star Trek movies. Is like, regardless of whether you consider it pure or lesser track, is like all the kudos to the filmmakers. I didn't pick up on the bullshit that I didn't like until the third viewing. You know, so
yeah. What about you, John?
At this point, like I am pretty open to, like, for the most part, I'm going to walk into any scenario and just, you know what, I'm just going to sit back, relax, and see where the ride takes me.
There you go. Best way to go about it.
Of course.
I don't watch trailers. I always go in with no expectations, because almost always I'll get some kind of disappointment, and the last thing I need is someone else.
Well, you know, I might watch a trailer or something, but I don't go, like,
I see hounding. A TV spot that's just 2 minutes, but anything,
I don't go
else.
Hounding shit out, you know. Yeah. I just I take it when it comes and I check it out, and you know, that has caused me some really, really long hours that I'm never gonna get back in my life, but it's also provided me with some truly amazing surprises that have become some of my favorite pieces of cinematography and art.
Are you also a cinematographer?
I was heading that route myself for a while. But I ended up leaning a little bit more into audio and sound design instead. But I now find myself kind of coming full circle. Like, now that I've been doing this whole paranormal investigation thing, oh man, I need to flex my camera muscles. That's for sure.
Yeah. But the audio, that's one thing that I struggle with it personally. It was one of those things that, you know, every time I try to do a production, that was one thing I was like, oh, audio, at least with the video or video or film or whatever, you can see it.
Man, I'll trade you an hour for an hour of friend guiding through the opposite ends of it, because I got the audio end locked down and I'm more than happy to help.
Right on. Well, and if you do sound design, we may talk in the future. That's for sure.
And you got to stick with someone like who's familiar with all areas. Like, what can they see? Because I've had that too, where it's like I would see two, like, camera A and B bicker with each other. It's like, well, what you see isn't what everyone else sees, yada, yada, you know? And then same thing with the sound guys. It's like some of them would just be very, I mean, even when we were getting into podcasting, we would see some guys say, okay, what you're hearing is pretty minor in comparison to what is truly just a strain on the ears, where it sounds like white noise, you know? This is like, and
it really is, you know, mastering and, you know, compressing, like, you have to go through a whole train wreck of stuff in order to get stuff to sound right. So
and it's just
it takes some work. So you may have the sound perfectly, you'll just probably have to trim down the gain insanely and then compress it and then all that.
That's the problem, the
limiter, gain, and then boost the volume up. It's a whole mess of stuff. But
the biggest issue is the fade outs. Just like, okay, music is ending, so start declining in the volume and then let the sound and, you know, room tone, you know, sink in, you know,
the dialogue. It's pretty easy if you're using Pro Tools, to be honest.
It is a great tool. And that's where it gets even harder too. You got people who also just refuse to use certain software, and so then it becomes that kind of measuring contest. I want to use Adobe. Oh, I only use Final Cut 10. I only use this.
They all work the same. Like, the language is translatable from one program to another.
If you
downloaded Audacity, I could apply everything I know about Pro Tools to that. But hey, oh God, guys. All right. So I'm really running out of time. But before I go, James, I would definitely like to touch base with you and talk tech with you and maybe share a little bit of knowledge. Cam, thank you so much for having me on, man. This has been a blast.
Likewise.
And I definitely got to be the first of many. This conversation is not over, gentlemen. We did not even really touch on split on all those.
We can schedule a part two for another day, and I'll
probably gonna be like part one of five at this point. Let's be real about it. And I am down for it. Let's nerd the fuck out on this shit. I love it. But yeah, guys, thank you so much for having me. I'm sorry I got to go.
No, it's a pleasure. I'm glad we got to chat.
Yeah, hello. Wouldn't have missed it for the world.
Minds network over these podcasts. That's great, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So peace be with you all. I'll catch up with you soon, all right?
Right on, John.
Totally. Bye. Thank you all.
So, are you still there?
Yep, always.
All right. So did you need to do, like, you want to, I mean, I know that we're kind of ending time here. You're still recording, correct?
Correct. Yeah.
Was there anything you could think of? Man, let's talk, you know, glass.
I mean, you were already on a good trail on just showing how just interconnected the lights, the colors, and other just stuff that is just so often just overshadowed in so many movies nowadays. I would even say that the cinematography really is a big star in this, just because not everyone can light a scene in the dark very well, you know?
right.
Yeah, everyone can use natural lighting versus studio lighting. And I also, it was so cool researching this, because this is like, I can't think of any other time where Disney and Universal have been involved, other than I was told that with Shang-Chi that the Abomination from the Incredible Hulk universe appears, and they kind of had to plead to have that character appear in Disney's Marvel universe again. So it is very interesting how this was it happened by accidents, by chance, by Shyamalan being smarter than the average bear. And
right.
And I mean, I think you pretty much summed up how each character really is very contained. And gets their, you can't say that any of them got underused. You know, it's like Glass he's felt before he even appears when you get to him in the psychiatric home. And much like how you loved how the kid was grown up, I really dug how they brought back his apologetic mother, who was just like, lost it.
Absolutely.
You know, but he was framed and he didn't really mean it. I don't believe it. Always imprisoning black folks. And so I was just like, man, it's just like the only person more unapologetic than the villain is the villain's mother.
Right. Right.
And so that was a cool angle to see, you know, it's like, cause we don't even hear anything else about Dunn's family. And it was just so cool how they had that angle. I like how he stumbles upon it. They don't waste any other time. I mean, yes.
Right. I mean, you know that she, you know, his wife passed, you know, they mm-hmm. they talk about that. And, but yeah, I think that he did a good job with these three. I mean, you know, like I said, like we were saying earlier, it's not a perfect score across the board.
No.
But for the most part, I think this is a solid trilogy, and I would like to sit back and watch. You know,
do a marathon.
I haven't. I just actually rewatched Unbreakable before the podcast.
Oh, good on you, buddy.
I just really wanted to see it again. It'd been a while.
And then
so Split is the one I want to watch again next, because I've seen Glass and Unbreakable, and that's just been, you know, Split was kind of in the middle there, and especially if we're going to have another chat, you know, in the future, you know, I'll definitely have to rewatch it to you know, familiarize myself again. But I appreciate you bringing me on. It's been good.
Absolutely. And I can't wait to do our you know, chat Q&A with your movie, you know.
Yeah, great. I will. We'll get that scheduled and bring the director on, and we'll be good to go.
Yeah, director. And you know, you're iffy on the actors. I get that. You know, everyone gets busy during the holidays, and they're often unreachable. So, you know.
Right. Yeah. He's reaching out to her right now, and hopefully, we'll you know, your audience will get.
I was so guffawing at his joke he made.
Yeah.
James Cameron.
Well, yeah, so we'll get that scheduled and your audience will get
I'm sorry about the wait. I won't do that. It's just I've been doing two back-to-back chats.
right on. Well, and I'm glad we got it to work
totally. And I was finding with the franchises that we got to schedule them outside of the main schedule, because often anyone can commit a day to like talking about a filmmaker or a rock band, but with a franchise, sometimes the day that you thought would work just doesn't end up working. It just always is. It's just like, you got to kind of just do it more just individually.
Yeah. Well, and then, you know, it's a conversation is a conversation. I mean, if we, you know, we kind of have made this one work as far as touching on each of them just enough mm-hmm. and, you know, bringing them all together, and, you know, it helps, you know, when it's a, you know,
when it's a round table.
Yeah, absolutely.
We'll return after these messages.
Hey, feeling down? Feeling low? Not enough podcasts about movies in your life? Why not try?
They must be destroyed on sight!
The new podcast cure-all, sure to get you right with the world and on a path to better living. We have exploitation, we have Italian horror, we have zombies, we have slashers, we have crime films, we have spaghetti westerns, we even have sci-fi and sex comedies. So take a dose of...
They must be destroyed on sight!
As needed, and let the hosts, Lee Russell, Daniel Harper, Paul Romali, and the odd guest host cure what ails you.
Warning, may cause atrophy, African consumption, black fever, bone shave, chin cough, colic, cramp colic, dropsy of the brain, elephantitis, grocer's itch, jaundice, mania, miasma, mortification, palsy, Pott's disease, rheumatism, scurvy, St. Anthony's fire, summer complaint, and worm fit in some people. Consult a physician before listening.
Did you ever see a film at such a young age it left you traumatized with cinematic wounds?
Necrophilia.
It's a dead issue, man. Don't push it. Cinema Psyops is a weekly podcast documenting an ongoing experiment on the mind of an unwilling test subject.
No one should have to watch this movie.
Oh, no one should have to watch this?
No one should have to watch this movie.
Surprisingly, it's not a topic that a lot of people really want to tackle.
I'm shocked, prudes.
I know, really.
Right?
the next sexual frontier that no one wants to explore.
I am, in the most sincerest of senses, disappointed in you.
It takes a powerful goddess like Connie, jam her arm down the monster's throat and kill it. Oh, I'm still tripping out over that. Even as a kid, I was like, I gotta find a girl like that. Every week, I get a new look of disappointment that I never thought I could get out of
it. Unimaginable. At 12 years old, you should not be watching this movie.
Obviously.
At 13, you should not be. 14, you shouldn't be. I'm not entirely sure even 17-year-olds should be watching this movie.
Just because you're offended by something doesn't mean that you have the right to demand that it doesn't exist.
Watching this film again, I had all of this like little nerd glee with everything that kept popping up.
Little history doll popping up at you.
So I totally loved this film.
Hey, I know why you know, couldn't see that. It's because your brain's warped watching this shit at 12 years old.
Yeah, this is a rough movie. I told you ahead of time when we were getting ready to do it that it was going to be a rough
one. How did you watch this shit at 12?
Because physical wounds heal, cinematic ones don't. Listen to Cinema Psyops.
Hey everybody, I'm Corey.
And I'm Zach. And we're the hosts of Podcasting After Dark, a cast dedicated to late-night horror and sci-fi of the 80s and 90s, often found on HBO and Cinemax.
You know, the movies your parents didn't want you watching as a kid. You can find us every other week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, and Stitcher.
This is what you want.
This is what you get.
It's late, it's time, let's check our cue, baby. Pair it with a couple brews, baby. We love good movies. We love the bad ones too. So we watch them all and pass their lessons on to you. Oh yeah.
Bana 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 out. Bana 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 out.
Everything I learned from movies helps to make life a little bit groovy. With a one-liner plot holes, a gratuitous movement. It's time to get busy with your friend Steven Izzy
at EILFM.podbean.com.
Welcome to Who Was She Podcast. I am your host, Tara Jabari. After a decade working in documentaries, marketing, and all things digital media, I found that podcasting is a strong medium to share stories. After years of producing for others, I decided to start my own biographical podcast. Who Was She will focus on the life of a woman throughout Baha'i history. The first season is about Lydia Zemanoff. Lydia's story explores the subjects of the power of language and faith. Her father invented the universal language Esperanto, and she came from a Jewish family and became a Baha'i. She grew up during World War I and was killed during World War II in a concentration camp, despite heroic efforts to save her life. How can one person's life intersect with so many others, connect across borders, and inspire a biography which inspired this podcast? Over the next few weeks, I will share her story with you and the lives that were most affected by her and those who affected her life as well. They include her father, Ludwig Zemanoff, her spiritual mother, American journalist Martha Root, and the Baha'i German soldier Fritz Mako, who worked for the resistance undercover while having to serve the Nazi party. I want to thank the author Wendy Heller and George Ronald Publishing for their blessing to let me use Heller's biography, Lydia, The Life of Lydia Zemanoff, Daughter of Esperanto, as a main and instrumental resource for this podcast. So please subscribe and learn about this amazing woman who traveled through three continents in an effort to bring unity through the power of language. You can also find more information on our Instagram, Facebook, and Pinterest at Who Was She Podcast. Music was composed and performed by Sam Red. I am your host, Tara Jabari. Join us next time as we begin our journey about Lydia Zemanoff.
Are you sick of the same old stale podcasts? Well, then join Vanessa and Darren as they dissect movies of all kinds. The two lifelong cinema lovers bring their favorites, curiosities, and first-time watches to the operating table and inject them with a healthy dose of snark. Then there's the waiting room, where they examine books and short stories. So just look for them on Apple Podcasts, and where fine podcasts are available. They're part of the Legion Podcast Network. Follow them on Twitter at VD Clinic Pod. Join them on Facebook at facebook.com/groups/VD Clinic Pod. Or email them at vdclinicpod@gmail.com. They're ready to cure what ails you. And still, they just might be a little contagious.
Hi there. It's Heather from the Watching Netflix Without You podcast. Did you know that there are over 1,200 Netflix original feature films and documentaries? And that number is only growing. So I've made it my mission to watch as many as I possibly can. Then, with a delightful guest or guests, disclaimer, more often than not my brother Ryan, we spend an episode rating, reviewing, and discussing a film at length. The first half of every episode is spoiler-free for those who haven't seen it yet, and in the second half, after a very clear spoiler warning, we dive into it. And that's really about it. You can listen to Watching Netflix Without You on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and more.
We now continue with our program.
Follow us on the web on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The podcast is available on Podbean, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Anchor, Apple, and anywhere else podcasts are available. Feel free to review our show and leave comments on any of those sites. Thanks a million for listening. It's a jacked up.